Tuesday and Wednesday.
Are you ready? Friday.
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Hi, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You might notice my voice is a little bit hoarse. I hope you'll forgive me for that, but I'm getting over it. J.P. Morgan wants to charge you fees so that you can't get to your own financial data without buying it from your bank. Now, that very idea sounds really bizarre to me, so I thought we'd get Todd Zawicki to explain it. Todd is at George Mason University's Foundation as a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason and former executive director of the George Mason Law and Economics Center. Todd, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars. Great to be with you today.
So what is happening? I don't think much of the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I think it's an unconstitutional agency, but it exists. And they are now adopting something called the Personal Financial Data Rights Rule. Would you mind explaining to my audience what that's all about?
No, I'd love to. The CFPB's been a bit of a train wreck since it got going. And to the credit, the Trump administration is trying to bring it to heel. And one of the things they're doing is this Personal Finance Data Rule. And interestingly enough, this was goes all the way back to Dodd-Frank when that was passed way back in 2010. And finally, during the Biden administration, they issued a rule, but it was so much like the Biden administration, a bit of regulatory overreach. So the Trump administration has come in and pulled that rule back and is putting out a new rule. And what the idea of this is think about being like your cell phone, and think about how the world changed when you could change your cell phone carrier but keep your same cell phone number.
Yep.
And that's what they're trying to do here, which is to try to increase competition and consumer choice among banks by enabling consumers to be able to collect their data that their bank has, the bank knows a lot about you, and be able to make it easy to take that to another financial service provider so that you can get better offers, so that you're upset with your bank, you can, you know, get a new bank, or you can get novel products like fintech products and that sort of thing. And so that's what this rule is about, which is trying to give us access to our data and be able to transport it easily to other banks or data aggregators who might be able to help us find products that are cheaper and meet our needs better.
I mean, Todd, am I imagining this right way? Because a lot of this may sound like 30,000 feet to some people. It does to me a little bit. But if I said, I want to copy all my data from, say J.P. Morgan Chase. I do have a Chase account. And then somebody says, Lars, if you'll let us look at that data, we'll tell you where you've been keeping this money in a savings account. You're not getting much return on that. You've been running it through a checking account. You're paying fees that we won't charge you. It's that kind of thing where just being able to do apples to apples, you could say, yeah, these guys are offering me a better deal, fewer of the downsides of my current account, some upsides I don't have now. But to be able to get to that, J.P. Morgan Chase wants to charge me to get access to my own data, to be able to compare with their competition?
Yeah, well, that's the idea. You said it exactly right. And it goes beyond that, right? It allows you to give information to data aggregators. You know, some people probably use Mint, right, which is where they can bring in all their credit cards from different banks and their bank accounts. There's some amazing things out there, Lars. Like one that I learned about is something called age tech, where this is incredible to think about, but you can spot early dementia earlier by looking at somebody's financial use patterns.
You're kidding.
As opposed to a doctor. No, wow. That people start to get irregular, that, you know, they start missing paying bills they've traditionally paid and or
maybe pay them twice.
Purchase, right? But that requires sort of being able to get access to all of somebody's accounts everywhere they are, right, and put them in one place. And so what the banks want to say is you can go in and you can get you can download on a spreadsheet your account from Bank A. You can go in and you can download your credit card account for B, but you can't take all that and bundle it up and put it in one place and basically have somebody shop around for you, like you're saying, right? Or put it in one of these age tech type things. And that's where they wanted to charge these exorbitant fees. They say you can have it, but you can't really do much with it, right? You're going to still have to search around with it. What you want to be able to do is get it, get all your information in one place, like you're saying, figure out where the best deals are and be able to cancel your bank account at A, move your stuff to B, and basically upload all that data into bank B much quicker. And that's where they're trying to bring the hammer down to prevent these third-party data aggregators that people use a lot to help rationalize their finance, plan their budget, and draw on information from a lot of different banks. And that's what this rule is trying to do,
well,
enable you to do that.
And Todd, I would imagine that the very companies that might be willing to say, we could develop this product, but getting people to actually do all this point-to-point comparison, it's going to be horribly complicated. But if we could do it this way, we would go out and develop products specifically aimed at drawing in those customers. I mean, no more free toasters and things like that, but actually offer you something of value to say, if you'll move your accounts here, at the end of the year, we'll have saved you $1,000 in ridiculous fees and maybe extra interest that you've earned, that kind of thing. That would be a very attractive approach.
Exactly. And so what this is really a fight about is you just being able to download your various data. That doesn't help you a lot, right? It's going to still be a pain to move your checking account from bank A to bank B, right? What you want to have is a seamless way to do that where you can draw on technological type things that are out there now where you can put it into, you know, a third-party app. You know, there's these things called Plaid and things like that, and they can actually transport it all for you, right? They can get you to the new bank. They can find the new offers. They can, you know, get your money into new savings accounts with all that logistical rigmarole. And frankly, that's what the banks want to stop. The big banks want to keep you within their walled garden, right? They want to trap you basically by buying you in with, you know, repeat, you know, with on, you know, repeat billing and that sort of thing. What you want to be able to do is take that and basically automatically switch your mortgage payment to a new provider, right? Not have to go through and re-enter all the data and try to set that all up in another place. That's the dream here, right? That would be what would be great for consumers and great for competition and great for innovation.
So, Todd, what's it going to take to get that Section 1033 of Dodd-Frank to actually become what you've just described?
Yeah, well, first, it'll take, it's sort of, you know, to their credit. I mean, the first good thing is that the Trump administration has announced, you know, they pulled back the Biden administration thing. They originally said that they weren't going to do something, but then J.P. Morgan showed the way they might abuse the system. So they've got an ongoing rule. They're getting ready to announce a rulemaking. People are interested. You know, they can get information about it. They can file comments if they want to. But it's going to be a drawn-out process. You know, and the main thing will be just kind of monitoring and keep the heat on them so that the big banks don't try to use their clout, in my view, to try to shut this down, right, to try to draw the rule as narrowly as possible.
That's the way to do it. That's Todd Zwicky from George Mason University. He's a professor of law at Antonin Scalia Law School. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Speak now or forever hold your peace. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Whoa. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio welcome back to First Amendment Friday, I should say, because First Amendment Friday is the day we traditionally, for the last 30 years, open up the phone lines. But I want to talk to Justin Fulcher first. Now, Justin is the former senior advisor to Secretary of War Pete Hegseth and a leader of the Pentagon's Drone Dominance Initiative. Kind of like the name of that, Justin, by the way. But I was taken aback. You probably knew all about it when it happened. When I saw the word that they'd closed the airspace over El Paso, Texas, and they were closing it for, they were originally saying they were going to close it for 6 or 8 days. In the end, maybe even as long as 10 days. In the end, they didn't close it down nearly that long. But all of this had to do with Mexican cartel-operated drones? Tell me what's going on with that.
Well, I think, you know, this is certainly a very critical issue. I mean, anytime you're closing the airspace, especially for a security reason, I think it's a big wake-up call. But I think, you know, ultimately, you know, cartels are well-funded. We've known that they've used drones, you know, for recon and supporting their smuggling operations, and frankly, using it as kind of a reconnaissance platform against Border Patrol. But this is certainly a huge escalation of tactics going across the border potentially.
Okay, and am I right in guessing that the reason that the FAA had originally said we might have to shut it down for as long as 10 days is because the Pentagon saw an opportunity to maybe go test out some of their shiny new tools that they can use to take drones out of the air?
Well, I think that's a great deduction. I mean, ultimately, you know, the threats from Mexican drug cartels are certainly high, and it's been a common, you know, tactic that they've used recently is drones. And, you know, as part of the Drone Dominance Initiative, you have the offensive kind of drone components, but also, you know, the counter drone initiatives that stem through that. So, you know, ultimately, you know, this is a complex issue, you know, when it crosses the border, you know, with DHS as well as the Department of War. But ultimately, any time to get more reps and practice for counter drone defense, I think these actors are going to take it.
I mean, it sounds like the kind of thing that gives the Pentagon the opportunity to go out and literally test this kind of stuff. I mean, I used to make the argument that when military gets called into search and rescue in the continental United States or in the United States inside our borders, you say, well, we're wasting all that money. I said, no, this is great practice. If you practice taking people off, say, where I live in the Pacific Northwest, Northwest mountaintops, and having to fly helicopters close to mountains, I said, that's great practice for places like Afghanistan or other nasty places on the earth. It's not wasted money. It's practice actually put to a practical use. So in this case, does this give us the opportunity to go after some of these Mexican cartel drones?
You're absolutely right. Of course, you know, the military is practicing every single day, you know, in various parts, you know, in a controlled military base type environments. But, you know, real world practice is incredibly valuable, especially as the tactics that, you know, whether it be the cartels or lessons learned from drone use in the Ukraine conflict, the way that drones are being used are fundamentally changing warfare. And any chance the Pentagon can get to test out their new toys, they're definitely going to take it.
You know, Justin, I get this sense that you're having to sort out in your head, what are the things I can actually say publicly and whatnot? And if that's the case, I completely understand. You've probably got access to information that you'd have to kill me if you told me what it was. But do we know what the cartels are doing with this stuff now? I mean, given that the border is pretty securely shut down right now by the Trump administration, unlike the 4 years of President Autopen, are they using this to scout a border they can't get across anyway? Or are they using it as a replacement delivery method for some of the contraband they want to get across the line?
Well, I think it's a mix of both. I mean, the border, of course, is, you know, very hard shut down from any sort of land entry. But, you know, controlling the airspace, especially at, you know, 300 or 400 feet, is definitely a much more challenging task. That being said, I mean, the military, the Pentagon is completely on top of the threats. We're extremely familiar with the tactics, techniques, and procedures that the cartels are using. And ultimately, we have all of the required countermeasures to eliminate those threats.
Okay, so let me ask you this, Justin, and I'm not a lawyer, and I don't think you might be a lawyer, but I'm not. What happens when a non-state actor, I think I'd be correct in calling cartels a non-state actor, although they do seem to have the cooperation of President Sheinbaum's administration to some extent, probably on threat of death. When a non-state actor starts doing stuff that would be if a country was doing it to us, would be considered maybe an act of war, does that give us any more latitude to go after the bad guys who are doing this stuff? Or do we just have to wait till they fly their toys over the border before we shoot them down?
Well, I think it definitely does give us more latitude to operate and defend against that. I mean, as we've seen, President Trump, you know, wisely so, has designated a variety of different cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. And once those foreign terror organization designations are in place, that opens up, you know, a whole different realm of available countermeasures and available actions that, you know, we can legally take to combat them.
So what else are we going to have to see occasionally? American airports shut down as the Pentagon comes in to take action against things like these cartel intrusions? Or is there a way to shoot them down and still keep the passenger planes flying?
Well, I think that becomes a lot more challenging. Of course, anything that's happening on U.S. soil or near U.S. soil on the border, you know, protection of American lives are first and foremost the top priority. That being said, you know, defending our borders and securing our homeland is a top initiative that President Trump and Secretary Hegseth have widely, you know, deployed various countermeasures to get after. And so, you know, unfortunately, with the rise of very affordable and cheap drones, this is, you know, I wish I could say this were going away, but ultimately this is going to be, you know, a constant threat that we're going to always have to take into consideration.
Very good. Justin, anything else my audience ought to know about this threat to America and about what we're doing to counter it?
I think the biggest thing is our military is on top of it. Homeland Security is on top of it. There's a great collaboration between those two organizations. And despite the threat, we have a variety of countermeasures that are extremely effective against these threats.
Very good. That's Justin Fulcher, former senior advisor to Secretary of War Pete Hegseth and a leader of the Pentagon's Drone Dominance Initiative. And again, I love the name of that. It actually sends the right kind of message. It's First Amendment Friday, 866-439-5277 on the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
.org today.
Something to say but don't want to talk? Email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We keep hearing that young Americans cannot afford what their parents had. You know, the American dream, owning a house, a car, having going to college and all that. But the boomers, did the boomers really have it that much easier, or have other things changed just to change our perception of the problem? I thought we'd talk about it with Sam Sam, is your last name pronounced Borgi?
It's Borgi, correct.
Borgi. Is a finance analyst and researcher at Investors Observer, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to the program. You kind of, well, I guess my read on the piece that you wrote is that you tried to say this is kind of a false narrative that boomers had it easier and today's younger people have it tough. Tell me what we should know.
Yeah, so, I mean, you've seen that narrative quite a bit. It's a bit of a false dichotomy. I think every generation had its challenges. What we found, though, throughout the baby boomer generation and into today is that the cost of everything has gone up significantly. In dollar terms, the prices of homes, cars, and even college tuition, really since the 1970s and 80s, has gone through the roof. So that goes back to things like the value of the dollar, you know, the monetary policy, the debasement of the currency. That's affected everybody. So a lot of the baby boomers who were, you know, smart enough to get in on assets did well. You know, if they owned stocks, if they owned real estate. But for everybody else, the same challenges that we're facing today in terms of affordability started to creep up on the baby boomers as well. So we did a study just to kind of evaluate that, and we found that, again, the price of everything has been going up for several decades now. So owned assets will be left behind, and that's kind of the main message that we're seeing with this data.
Well, in fact, you did something interesting that I benchmarked things on gasoline costs or minimum wage, things like that. You benchmarked it off gold. So you said, okay, you think the cars were cheaper back in the 1970s. An Oldsmobile Cutlass, a brand new one, was 86 ounces of gold back then. Today you could buy a brand new Ford F-Series pickup truck for 8 ounces of gold. Sounds like, if you benchmark it that way, a lot of things have actually gone down in price.
Exactly. So mentioned earlier in U.S. dollars, really since 1910, everything is up about 133-fold measured in dollars. But when you measure it in ounces of gold, things are about 42% cheaper over the past.
I think we lost. Sam, are you still there? Let me get Sam back on the line. Sam, sorry about that little technical problem. What were you saying, though, about how should we really look at this? And why is it that millennials now perceive that they're just unable to do what their mothers and fathers, grandmothers and grandfathers did?
Yeah, as I was mentioning, gold is real money. And if you invested in gold over this period, you found that everything has gone cheaper. As I mentioned, over the past 100 years or so, everything from housing to college tuition to automobiles are about 42% cheaper. You compare that when you benchmark it in dollars, things are 133 times more expensive. So in terms of millennials and that nature, I think that the main issue today, obviously, is the housing market. Home prices have gone up and up. We've had some corrections over the past several decades, but it's been a cumulative gain in home prices. And we found that a lot of the millennials and the Gen Zs are now really struggling to build wealth through the housing market. So the baby boomers had one thing going for them in the sense that you saw interest rates gradually decline over the years. And historically, interest rates are still pretty low today, but millennials are having a harder time getting into the market because housing prices are so elevated. I think the median housing cost right now in the U.S. is like between $460,000 to $500,000, depending on how you analyze the median versus average. But you combine that with the labor market, the decline in manufacturing jobs, and the fact that we need to go to college now to get work. Well, how valuable is a college degree? That depends on who you ask and what degree you're going into. But housing is more expensive. The value of a college degree is no longer as obvious as it once was. And all these things are making it a lot harder for millennials to build wealth and for Gen Z to build wealth compared maybe to their parents.
And yet, Sam, one of the things I've noticed, the trades right now, the construction trades, they pay very, very well. People routinely make six figures, low six figures, working in construction. And you say, well, those jobs are there and you don't need a college degree to get it. And if you get the college degree, pouring coffee for a living is what an awful lot of college degree holders are doing right now because college degrees are kind of a dime a dozen. Everybody's got one. Am I wrong in looking at it that way?
No, you're absolutely correct in looking at it that way. There is some data that shows that overall, over the lifetime of a career, college degrees still out-earn non-college degrees, but there's a lot of caveats to that. It depends on what you majored in. It depends on where you're working. A lot of the skilled trades are, as you mentioned, have a lot of opportunity. There's labor shortages potentially. Nobody wants to be plumbers and working construction anymore. Now the key is to convince millennials and Gen Z to actually go into those professions. Right now they're still chasing the college degrees because they think that's going to be their ticket to a career. Work has to be done. There's a lot of work in the economy that needs to be done. And you mentioned construction. Plumbing is another, skilled trades are another. The question, though, is getting these younger generations to see that. It's probably not as appealing conceptually to enter the trades versus a college degree, given what we've been told repeatedly by the school system over the last several decades that a college degree is the end-all be-all. So I think it requires a change in mindset, and right now, people are starting to realize that the hard way because, if you're pouring coffee for a living and you have $100,000 in student loans, your life's not going to work that way. Something's going to have to give.
Yeah, and in fact, we've got a plumber in the family, and he's a nice part of the family. I won't name him, but he makes about a buck and a half a year. I mean, he's making great money. And every time I pull up to a place to buy a cup of coffee from somebody who's probably making just above minimum wage, I wonder, why aren't you out, making 10 times the money or 8 times the money anyway? To actually go out and do something and be able to point to it and say, I plumbed that building, as opposed to I poured those 10,000 cups of coffee. That doesn't seem to be a point of pride for anyone.
No, obviously, people who take working below their capacity, right? You didn't go to school to pour coffee. You went to school to, you know, major in whatever liberal arts. Marine biologist, you know, you have, psychology is a big one. Sociology is another big one. But do those actually pay in the long run? The answer is, we're starting to see, is no. Demand isn't there. Ultimately, it's a function of supply and demand. The market does not demand those skills. We have to have an honest conversation about what we're doing in college. And it's great to learn about these things. You want to learn about the humanities, about social sciences, go ahead, but don't spend $1.50, $1.50 learning about them, you know? So well, that's the big issue.
Yeah, and Sam, what frustrates me is when people say, well, you know, but I got my degree. They owe me six figures. No, they don't. You should have maybe 4 years before you started that degree said, what do the jobs I can actually get with this degree actually pay? That's Sam Borgi. He's a finance analyst at Investors Observer. Sam, thanks very much. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Listen to Lars live? No problem. Get the podcast 24/7 at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, some of this stuff sounds so crazy that it sounds almost like the Babylon Bee was writing it. Imagine a state that is notorious, or I guess famous, for having a lot of snow in the wintertime, and they decide to spend $8 million in federal funds on electric buses, and they can't figure out whether or not they run in cold weather and in snowy times. Well, I thought we'd talk about it with Larry Behrens, who's communications director for Power of the Future. Larry, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars. So great to talk with you.
So what happened in this case? How in the world did they drop $8 million on five electric buses? I mean, hasn't this country already had a very bad record when it comes to success when electric buses are introduced almost anywhere in the country?
Yeah, they have, and that's why we're asking them to look into it. And I guess to answer the question, why did they not, drop $8 million or look at it before they did? I guess they thought, you know, I can't open a Somali daycare, so I'll just throw $8 million at five buses. That's $1.6 million, just under, per bus. That's three times the cost of a diesel bus. And what happened was, first, the battery was recalled, so they could not literally store them inside because of the fire hazard. And then they found out that, well, that same battery cannot charge in temperatures that are less than 41 degrees, which, lo and behold, happens in Vermont. And so these buses are completely sidelined until they get a software update, which we're told would happen in the next 12 to 24 months. And it is a massive, massive waste of money. And it's all to virtue signal, right? This is not that there are products that are available to drive people around that do not require to be charged and can still work in under 41 degrees. But they had to have these and spend more of our money to do it. And lo and behold, I don't think they really care that the buses don't work, because the whole point was just to spend the money.
Yeah, and Larry, you mentioned the fire safety issue. I saw an amazing piece of video, I'm sure you've seen it as well, a fire captain being interviewed, I think, by a member of the legislature. I don't think it was the U.S. Congress. And he was being asked, so when you had a fire at that place that involved, these big batteries, the lithium-ion batteries, why didn't you put it out? He said, our policy is not to put them out, because if you put them out with water, the conventional way to put out fires, you can end up with an explosion hazard. So our policy now is to let them burn. So the thing that's being adopted at very great expense to have these electric-powered buses, that if they ever catch fire, they're not only a hazard to life and safety, safety, but the policy is to just let them burn until they burn out. So these buses in Vermont can't be put in a heated garage because that's a fire danger. But if you leave them outside in the weather, then you can't charge them.
That's exactly it. And think about it. If one of these buses, heaven forbid, catches fire, here's your fireman's choice. Do I just let it burn and that's toxic smoke, or do I try to put it out and that's toxic water? That's the two choices you have when these things catch fire. And they do catch fire. And we all saw that, you know, former Vice President Kamala Harris was very excited about introducing electric school buses. So let's go ahead and put our children on these as well. And that's another program that has thankfully had its budget cut, but is just a complete, I have to call it a grift.
Well, in fact, Larry, one of the things I did a couple of years ago, there was a local transit agency in my neck of the woods that wanted to buy some of these electric buses. And I asked them for all the numbers. And they said, well, why do you want those numbers? I said, I just want to do a comparison. And I happen to remember it. The bus cost twice as much, $1 million instead of about $500,000, at least in the case of those. I said, what's the expected lifespan of a diesel bus? And they said, 16 years. I said, how about the electric bus? 12 years. You say, okay, yeah. So it's three quarters the length. I said, what about the fuel cost? Because people forget that electricity costs money. Well, they said, well, we save a lot because diesel would cost us at that time $12,000 a year, and the electricity only costs us $9,000. I said, so you're saving $3,000 a year while you're spending an extra $500,000 on the bus? I mean, even ignoring the lifespan, you're talking about a payoff time of 125 years. Except the bus isn't going to last 125 years. It's only going to last a dozen years.
My favorite part of that story is when you start asking questions like, why the sudden need for information? Why do you suddenly need to know the truth? They don't want us putting together the 2 plus 2, the fact that they're saying it equals 7 on these electric buses. And so, yeah, they're overspending our tax dollars for them. We are entitled to ask those questions. But it is all about what you know it's about, Lars. It is all about virtue signaling. They want to be there for the ribbon cutting. They want to be there to say, look how great we are. And then you never, that most of the public never again asks, are these things actually moving? Are these things actually getting charged? Or are they just really nice centerpieces near the school district office or near the transit office? Or in the case of these buses in New Hampshire, are they really nice snow catchers in a storm?
That's what it sounds like. That's Larry Behrens, the communications director for Power of the Future. Let me grab one call quickly. Darcy, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I was calling about the immigration, the woman who was talking about it earlier.
Yep.
And my dad came here 66 years ago next month.
Did he come legally?
My dad came with a green card. They applied in 1957. He's Dutch Indonesian. And if you were not a refugee, you had to wait longer.
Yep.
They weren't refugee status. So
they
1957.
Do. Because if they get refugee status, they get to be on the dole forever.
Yes. And they came here in 1960. They had recruited my grandpa from the Netherlands to help with some bridges in a town across the river from me. And, you know, it's really offensive. My dad will be 85 next month as well.
Yep.
Very Democrat. Very Democrat. But getting very, very distressed and tired of hearing people not even knowing immigration.
That's exactly it. Darcy, I appreciate the comments, and God bless your dad for doing it the legal way. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson Show.
American financing helps.
The information you need when you want it. FM News 101 KXL is Portland's number one source for news and information. KXL FM, Portland, Vancouver, Salem.
From ABC News, I'm Wayne Cabot. The water is so high in Dallas, cars are stranded on streets. It's from the remains of our first tropical storm of the season, Arthur, drenching the Gulf Coast.
The rates are about 2 to 3 inches of rainfall per hour and 6 inches possible. So the already 12 or more inches we've received in some places. Other areas in some spots, over 20 inches of rainfall.
ABC News meteorologist Leslie Lopez, two people died this morning in Putnam County, Georgia. A large tree fell on their moving truck, the ground so saturated. Israel and Hezbollah have a new ceasefire right now after fighting this morning killed 47 people in Lebanon. The White House has called Vice President J.D. Vance back from scheduled peace talks with Iran. The Trump administration is refusing a federal judge's order that Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche provide a signed statement verifying that the Justice Department will not pursue the anti-weaponization fund, a slush fund, say critics of both parties, $1.8 billion to compensate Americans at Trump's discretion. The DOJ today saying that the statement is unnecessary. The judge demanded it when officials refused to say under oath that the deal was dead. More about the test of presidential powers from ABC's Stephen Portnoy.
Asked about the limits on his power vis-a-vis the conflict with Iran, President Trump told Axios.
There are no limits.
No.
No, not. I haven't learned that lesson yet. I know there are, but, you know, there are no limits.
As for his relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu.
It's good, but we have to keep him a little bit sane.
Asked if Israel will abide by the terms of the ceasefire with Iran by not striking Lebanon, Trump said top Israeli officials respect him.
And they do as I say.
Stephen Portnoy, ABC News, Washington.
UK Prime Minister Starmer says he plans to fight for his job, but a growing number of colleagues are urging him to make way for Andy Burnham as Prime Minister. You're listening to ABC News.
Hot man, I love this place. I've been surfing here since I was a kid. Now, seeing my grandson out on the water, it means everything to me. Watching him and taking in the blue waves, the sea breeze, the blurry horizon.
If you have geographic atrophy, or GA, subtle changes in vision could mean it's progressing toward irreversible vision loss. Izervay is proven to slow GA progression and could help preserve your vision for longer, so you may keep seeing the world around you. Izervay, or Avastin Captid Pegol, is an eye injection. Don't take it if you have an infection or active swelling in or around your eye. Izervay can cause eye infection, retinal detachment, or increased risk of wet AMD. Izervay may cause blood in the white of the eye, blurred vision, or a temporary increase in eye pressure. Do not drive or use machinery until vision has recovered after an eye injection or exam. Ask your retina specialist how you can slow your GA with Izervay. To learn more, call 1-855-IZERVAY or go to izervay.com. Paid for by Astellas Pharma.
Friday Night Fever.
Yes, Friday. Woo!
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
The government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Thursday. It's also a pleasure to welcome back to the program the managing editor at Willamette Week, and that's Aaron Mesh. You can find what's written at Willamette Week at WWeek.com. Aaron, welcome back.
Good to be here.
What is going on when Portland's Housing Authority sounds like a gigantic financial train wreck that is not delivering the housing that, at least in theory, it's supposed to deliver, and yet it's handing out gigantic raises to people who work for a public agency?
Yeah, the one thing that's extremely clear and what is, all, quite frankly, a muddy and opaque financial situation for Home Forward is that the executives are coming out of it quite well. So Sophie Peel has spent much of the last 6 weeks digging into the finances and the conditions at Home Forward's affordable housing portfolio.
Yeah.
The housing agency for the city, which is a really strange governmental nonprofit that we describe it in the story as neither fish nor fowl. It's one of those very strange public-private partnership nonprofits. At any rate, mostly using federal money. And it has a portfolio of 7,000 low-income units, most of which, as I'm sure your listeners understand, are subsidized by housing vouchers from the federal government, and the people who live in them pay a little bit, but not most of the rent.
Yep.
And despite all of that, and despite the fact that there's a pretty steady stream of Uncle Sugar's dollars flowing in here, right?
Yep.
There is still an inability by Home Forward to pay off its loans on many of these buildings. So remember that when you're building affordable housing, just like when you're building any kind of major housing project, almost certainly a bank or some other fiduciary lender is going to give you some of the money up front and then expect you to pay it back over time, whether that's through bonding mechanisms or just like straight up bank loans. So Home Forward is carrying an enormous amount of debt on its buildings. That's not uncommon, and it's not bad practice. The problem is that it's not collecting enough money in its buildings from the federal government or its tenants to pay back those loans in a timely fashion, and it's having to move money around from building to building to make payments.
That sounds like it's fraudulent. I mean, if you say, well, we have these loans and we owe the money, well, we'll just shuffle some money around and keep everybody happy. If you've got 7,000 of so-called affordable housing units, you're getting money from both the state and federal government, you have 1,000 units empty, and it's taking you over 6 months to fill the average one, and your units, it turns out, are renting even subsidized at about the same cost as private sector units. It sounds like the whole thing is a giant financial mess that doesn't make any sense. And then you throw in on top of it, when John Charles from Cascade Policy points out the average affordable housing unit is built at $800,000, where the private sector builds them for about half as much as that. It sounds like affordable immediately means unaffordable.
John is correct, and you may recall that Nigel Jaquist was writing about the high cost per square foot of affordable housing a decade ago. It continues to be a major problem. And the question of why Home Forward is so underwater on so many of its buildings is a complicated one, and one that I think Sophie has done the Lord's work in trying to dig out, just given how opaque its finances are. But it is not good, as you pointed out, that it takes them 6 months to fill a unit that adds up to 10% of their or sometimes 14% in the last year of their units are sitting empty. Because every
it also belies the argument that we're in a housing crisis, doesn't it? If you say we're in a housing crisis, we're short of housing. Really, you've got 1,000 empty units that are subsidized. Where's the crisis?
Well, the crisis is evident to you on the streets, right? Like, there's obviously a lot of people who are visibly suffering and behaving poorly. The question, of course, which is a large debate, is like whether or not that thing that you're seeing on the streets is a housing stock problem, is it a drug addiction problem,
drugs
is it
and mental.
A governmental mismanagement problem?
I think
what
it's
exactly
drugs and mental.
Is it?
Aaron,
what is driving it?
Well, drugs and mental illness. And I've been saying that for a couple of decades, and people say, no, it's because apartment rents are too expensive. And I said, really? You've walked by the guy who's shooting meth or smoking meth on the street, living in a tent, and you say, why, if apartments were just a couple of $100 cheaper, that guy would be living in a nice apartment. You say, what part of his circumstances makes you believe that?
No, I understand what you're saying, and that may in fact be a factor in some of Home Forward's struggles, is that if they are in fact struggling to find tenants to occupy these buildings, some of that may simply be that, like, the people who they are marketing to are not in any condition to pay any rent, right? So, like, there are a lot of different factors here, all of which do not speak well to local prudence.
And by the way, let's talk about the raises. The fact that anybody in a pseudo-government agency like Home Forward, as you said, it's neither feast nor fowl. It's somewhere in the middle. It's an amalgam. You've got the CEO making $342,000 a year, big jump, 59% raise. The chief financial officer is making a 59% raise. You got the chief operating officer with a 68% raise. All these people are getting raises, and they're doing, by any account, a terrible job of managing this the operation, aren't they?
Yeah, in some ways, I think this is the most shocking part of the story, is that many of the problems that Home Forward is encountering are unique to them, but many of them are also potentially, like, problems that housing authorities are having across the country.
Right.
And yet, even granting that, none of them would suggest that the people in charge have earned themselves big paydays or big performance raises. So when you see a number like $342,000 a year, and that number started only 4 years ago at $215,000 a year, you have to ask the question of, like, what exactly did you do that was so impressive that that your salary should jump by a third and far outstrip that of many business owners in this city?
And by the way, I would suggest the reason they're not able to pay off their loans is because they say, look, we're sitting here with we got people, half the population is 7,000 living in our units, isn't paying the rent on time. And we've got 1,000 empty units. And when somebody says, boss, we need to raise the rents to get more money so we can pay our loans back. And the boss says, we're not renting stuff now at the rents we're offering. If we raise the rents, we're going to rent even fewer units. I think they're avoiding that, and they don't seem to care because they know the rest of us are going to end up picking up the tab. That's Aaron Mesh, managing editor at Willamette Week. You can find the story at WWeek.com, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show on Conspiracy.
Ryan Reynolds.
Local, national, Lars has you covered. Call him from anywhere. 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. It is great that after a long absence, we have Ryan Walters back with us. Ryan, so glad to have you back. Former Oklahoma State School Superintendent, CEO of the Teacher Freedom Alliance. How are you?
Hey, Lars, great talking to you again. Yes, sir. We've been working hard to destroy these teachers' unions across the country. So great, always great to be on with you.
Well, and it should be easy because after the Janus decision, you just tell the teachers, you don't have to be in this crazy group anymore. I would think that a lot of teachers would embrace that quickly. Are they?
Yeah, well, they are when you fight through all the union lies about it. I mean, Lars, you're exactly right. We got the Janus decision that says you don't have to join a teachers' union. But guess what? The teachers' unions go out and tell teachers, well, first of all, you do if you want your benefits, you want your retirement, you want to keep your job. And we're going, no, literally, that's what the decision says. You don't have to get those things. And the other thing the union's done that is, I'll give them credit, you know, I mean, you know, they have worked inside states to create environments that make it difficult for teachers to leave, like teacher certification. To keep teacher certification in all 50 states, you have to take trainings and personal development courses, things like that. Guess who's the only people who offer them in most states? Your teachers' union. So even if you leave, you got to go back and pay the union to keep your certification. Well, we've launched that in all 50 states where now actually there's another game in town and we're actually at conservative values and don't want to train your kids to be little Marxists. So right now we are growing very, very quickly across the country.
Well, let me ask you something. Is there a way to go in and substitute for those union-provided indoctrinations of teachers, so they go off and indoctrinate the students? Is there a way to say we'd like to be an alternate provider of certification? Because you know, I can think of models in other businesses where private sector replacements could be made and say, why are you letting the unions control this? They have a political dog in the fight. We'll do certification too. Any way to do that?
Yeah, no, and that's absolutely what we're doing. We provide all the courses in order for teachers to keep their certifications. The tricky thing is higher education. Higher education and teacher licensing, it's a complete racket. The Trump administration's been taking this head on. You know, in Oklahoma, we did something where we said, you know what, you don't have to go through a college of education. You know what, if you actually have real-world experience and you got a job in somewhere else, you're probably actually better trained to come in and teach math if you've worked in any kind of accounting or any kind of business of background or anything like that. So states are starting to come around. Arizona has done something similar, Florida. But we've got to continue to destroy the educational establishment by creating these ways to go, no, 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 you don't have to go be indoctrinated by a college of education. No, you don't have to go to the teachers union. Actually, if you're a high-quality individual that knows your content and wants to help kids, we want you in the classroom.
You know, it's funny, Ryan, because I've talked to a former shop teacher of mine. I loved shop, and I wish every school had it. And, you know, and I've said, why don't you have shop anymore? Well, it's tough to find a teacher who can teach it. I said, get a retired contractor. Get somebody who actually has run a skills saw and knows how to build things and have them go out and do it. And if you want them to take a, you know, a 9-week course at the community college on the ways you go about, you know, I don't know, doing all the paperwork or whatever. But I would think a retired, you know, contractor would be a better teacher of that. And I do remember years ago, there was a doctor, a medical doctor, who was an emergency room doc. He was a Democrat, but he became governor, and he used to complain. He said, you know, I couldn't teach a class in basic biology in our local high school, even though I'm a medical doctor. That kind of, you're ignoring all that talent that could be in the schools.
Yeah, well, we work on this in Arizona. You know, they had former astronauts come forward and go, we couldn't teach a science class. Think about the absurdity of that, you know. And so, yeah, and I will tell you this, when you look around the country, some of the best educational institutions out there are the technical schools, your career techs, your vocational schools, because you know what they do? Guess who teaches the electrical course? An electrician, you know, and so guess what? It's amazing because number one, they know what they're doing, but number two, they're passionate about what they do. They bring real world experience. They love the jobs they've worked in, and they inspire young people from all over the country to get involved. The biggest issue with those schools is guess what? The teachers union doesn't make money off of them. Higher ed doesn't make money off of them. So those continue to be institutions that are not promoted in the way that these other institutions are. But I will say President Trump's done a great job of highlighting those, saying, listen, we need more of this and less of K-12 higher ed gobbledygook that doesn't even end in any kind of profession.
By the way, Ryan, you know, you made me remember a couple of things. There's a medical school, and I remember reading, they said, and I don't think they're unusual, they tell their doctors who teach at the medical school, which is also a hospital, a university hospital, they said, you have to maintain a clinical practice at least quarter time. And they said, why? Why do we have to do this? Because you can't teach it if you don't actually do it. And I remember there was a guy at, I think, American University in D.C. way back when who taught criminal justice. You know what he did halftime? He was a cop. But he also had the academic credentials. And so he said, when I talk about the Miranda rights, I actually give them to people. I actually put handcuffs on people. I deal with this problem in a real way. It's not just theoretical. I would think any university would strengthen their offering if they actually said, to teach this, you have to show us you know how to do it.
Are you ready for this, Lars? I did ding every college of education in the state of Oklahoma because none of them met their requirement of people who actually teach teachers should spend time in a K-12 classroom. None of them met their hours. And I go, guys, this isn't a big ask, but you know what? If you're teaching a kid or you're teaching a teacher how to teach a kid, we actually would have want you to actually taught a kid at some point in your life. And they just all scoffed at that. And it just shows you that mentality of, no, 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 we're academia. We don't need any real world experience. We don't need to be actually have ever done the thing. We're just going to philosophize about it. And that's where you see this get so off track because, of course, you've got the radical left wing indoctrination. But Lars, things like when they stop teaching reading correctly, they stop teaching phonics in reading. You're telling me that if you actually had people who had taught kids how to read, they would go up into a college and then say, forget everything that's worked for the last you know, decades and decades and decades. We're just going to do this completely differently, not based in any kind of real-world experience, but that's what you've got so many times in higher ed.
That is Ryan Walters, CEO of the Teacher Freedom Alliance.
The Lars Larson Show. Inside Lars's studio. Follow him on Instagram at the Lars Larson Show. Now, more with Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday night. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, we have always put naysayers to the head of the list. Even the naysayers who call, say, once a week, and they're trying to get a point across, I get the point. But here's my question. Would you rather have a show that actually entertains people who disagree with me? I would rather have that kind of show. I'd like to know what's going on. Last night, State of the Union address, I thought a fine performance by President Trump, made a lot of important points. The Democrats decided to be difficult and suggested somehow Donald Trump is dividing America by them not showing up to listen to his speech. Well, guess what? The SAVE Act is one of the key things that the president has been appealing for. And what that is to save American elections. We are very much at risk of losing our American elections. And how? Because we have an election system in which they're not insisting that you have to be a citizen to vote. They're not insisting that people have to show picture ID to vote. They're not insisting that the ballots have to be in by election day or they don't get counted. That's what the SAVE Act is all about. It is a law that would be a game changer for American elections. It has passed the House of Representatives twice. It should pass the Senate. Well, guess what? Big news came from Senate Majority Leader John Thune. Now, some of us have been very disappointed in Majority Leader Thune. He confirmed this morning that he will indeed bring the SAVE Act to the floor of the Senate. The move comes as President Trump continues to pivot the country toward common sense policies. Now, I'm quoting from the Gateway Pundit tonight because I've found to be trustworthy. During an interview, Thune was confronted with the undeniable reality. President Trump's State of the Union demand was clear. All voters must show voter ID. I mean, like New York now requires no voter ID to vote, but they do require picture ID to be able to shovel snow and collect a paycheck. The polling on the data is absolutely stunning. The Democrat Party, even members of the Democrat Party, even people who are racial minorities in America, they believe in voter ID and picture ID. On that note, I want to turn to Chad Wolf. It's great to welcome Mr. Wolf to the program again. Former acting secretary of DHS under Donald Trump, current vice chair of American Global Strategies and chairman of Homeland Security of AFPI. Mr. Wolf, welcome back.
Hey, thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Hey, are we in another space race and are we falling behind in the race to get back to the moon?
Well, I think the answer to both of those is yes. You know, it's interesting. I don't know that a lot of attention has been paid to this, but as you indicated, there is a space race, mainly between the United States and China. And space is important for a lot of different reasons, which President Trump in his first term with Space Force certainly recognized. But, you know, the United States, we need to get serious about it, because if China is not only first to the lunar surface again, but You know, they're not going to have the right intentions. They're not going to play well with others. And the security, the national security of our country really is at stake here. So the United States, you know, we need to sort of get our act together here a little bit, make sure that we have durable solutions. It's not enough just to get there one time, which would be great. But to make sure that we have a sustained presence there. And so how do you do that? You got to look at the current space program, NASA, the SLS and others. And I see that we're falling behind in that race.
I think you're right. Now, when you say we have to have a durable solution to this, does NASA fit the bill? Because my impression has been the private sector. I don't agree with a lot of things that Elon Musk has done and a lot of things he's pursuing, you know, post-humanism and all that. But I do agree that his space launch system seemed to work pretty well, and the private sector seems to be capable of doing what NASA can't do unless you give them a giant mountain of money.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think SpaceX, you know, with Elon Musk at the helm, has shown just that and has made remarkable progress in, you know, just a handful of years, which took NASA, NASA is incapable of doing what SpaceX has done with the reusable rockets and the like. And I think that's certainly what the Chinese are exploring now. And so when I look at the current space program and the SLS program, it doesn't have that same innovation. You know, it's sort of the stale old Lockheed Martin kind of approach of space travel. And I think we need to involve the privates a lot more and really look to innovate, to have that durable solution, to have cost effectiveness, to have the right payload systems, to get back to that lunar surface, which is just incredibly important now. When we think about satellites in space, you talk about GPS, you talk about all of that. If you own space and then you own, you know, everything that is below it and above it. And again, our national security, I think, is largely dependent on who controls space. And again, I think it's primarily why President Trump put together Space Force, because he understood that.
And in fact, that SLS you mentioned, they've spent $64 billion on that, and it costs $4.2 billion per launch.
Yeah.
I wonder how many SpaceX launches we could get for $4 billion. I'm guessing a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's it. It's you know, the cost, and to say, you know, after Artemis 3, which they've still got problems with Artemis 2 now, will NASA go in a different direction, or will they just keep their heads down and say, look, this is what we've always done, we're going to do it this way? Or are they going to look for some other innovative solutions and a different path forward? And I think it's not just enough to say we want to do space exploration for science and things like that. Yeah. Now we're talking about, again, the national security of the country at stake.
And I agree with you. I think China gets the high ground. China's going to keep the high ground at our expense. And I think that'll be intentional. Mr. Wolf, thanks so much for the time.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
That is Chad Wolf, the former acting Secretary of Homeland Security under Donald Trump in his first term. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. And I really have to wonder, Oregon, the state of Oregon, where I don't vote. I vote in the state of Washington. But if I voted in the state of Oregon, I would think there is a wealth of candidates who are running for the Republican nomination, whereas the Democrats are stuck with a very failed and very unpopular Tina Kotek. That doesn't mean they can't cheat their way to victory, although the SAVE Act, if passed by Congress, would actually tell Oregon you can only allow citizens to vote, and they have to have picture ID, and that might change the whole game. But one of the people who's seeking the Republican nomination is Dave Medina, who is grassroots leader in the Pacific Northwest, small business owner, and all-around good guy. How are you, David?
Hey, I'm good, Lars. How are you doing?
Not too bad, but given the way the state of Oregon is either running or not running, not functioning correctly, are you sure you'd want to be governor of all that?
Yeah, I'm sure. It's like, what part of the circus are we covering today? You know, it's I'm absolutely sure. I'm ready to fight for Oregonians. I've been fighting for them on the streets. I've been fighting for them, giving them a voice. I'm ready for this, Lars. I'm ready to take this on because guess what? The majority of Oregonians are tired of this nonsense. It's just we need strong leaders to get people to unlock people's courage.
I guess one of the biggest frustrations I have, David, from a distance, is that the state of Oregon is now taking up things like LGBTQ protections, and the city of Portland's taking up single stall bathrooms and whether or not they should be gender neutral. It's as though they don't even seem to be aware the state has major problems, and most of us could name them off very easily. You've got a bad economy. Right. You've got homelessness. You've got illegal aliens. You've got crime. You've got all these other problems. And you say, so what's the city of Portland doing? We're making sure that single stall bathrooms are gender neutral, and we're making sure there are protections in one of the most liberal states in America for LGBTQ++, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it just shows you what the priorities are. And since we're catering to mental health, I would like to know what they plan to do with my split personality folks. We need to have that. They need to have representation too. The single stall bathrooms are hateful towards them, Lars. But I'll just tell you this, we're catering to less than 1% of the population. I talk to Republicans and Democrats consistently in Oregon that don't want this agenda. They don't want this men and women's sports, girls or boys and girls sports. They don't want any of this nonsense. I just had a Democrat voter come up to me yesterday at my gym. I kid you not. He said, look, you know, I don't see things all the way you do. I tend to lean more left. But man, he said, not even kidding you, quote exactly. He said, this transgender stuff, this nonsense they're pushing on our children and all this is getting insane. And I said, that's why I'm running for governor, sir.
Well, it's even as, David, I saw a list this morning that came out of all the hospitals across the country that have dropped, said, at the very least, we're going to stop all surgical interventions in genitally mutilating children. I guess they're still going to do it to adults, but I thought, well, good for them. But, I don't even see any curiosity on the part of reporters to go to folks like the University of Washington or Oregon Health Sciences University and say, are you still doing this stuff while the rest of the country is abandoning it? You're still going to mutilate children. And they don't want to ask the question because, that would cause all the woke folks to clutch their pearls, and the fact that my old business, being a street reporter, is just unwilling to ask questions to which the answers on camera, I think, would drive all kinds of viewership toward TV news. But instead, they're just, we'll cover whatever it is the Democrats are doing and not even question why they're doing it.
Absolutely. And, this House Bill 4088 that they're pushing through to expand protections for mutilating our kids, that's what you got to call for what it is. We have to stop dancing around these issues. We're going to call it as it is, mutilating our kids, child abuse, and also expanding protections for abortions. Lars, the theme of the Democrats of Oregon has been, and we've seen it with the tax referendum, we've seen it with every other issue under the sun, these people do not care about the will of the Oregon people. They don't even care about people within their own party. They have an agenda to drive the state into the ground with their ideologies and their failed policies. Look at how they approach the illegal alien situation. When Trinity Aragua gang members tried to ram our federal agents, they came out right away. You guys all saw it in Portland. Tina Kotek, Keith Wilson, and Bob Day came out crying for the illegal aliens and with no remorse, no concern. And they already said, get ICE out of Portland before any information came out. These people need to be stopped. I believe I'm the only candidate that can do that, Lars, because I'm not afraid to call these issues out. And the majority of Oregonians have already been listening to me and supporting my work.
I'm talking to Dave Medina. Dave, tell people where to find your website before I go to a couple of other questions. But Dave's running for the GOP nomination for governor in Oregon.
Yeah, so it's MedinaForOregon.com, Medina, Oregon.com. You guys can donate. You can sign up to volunteer. And that's my website. Thank you, Lars.
And by the way, David, you know, on the illegal alien problem, I know there are people who say, well, but he's arresting all the illegals. I say, yeah, that's what Trump promised to do in the campaign. And 77 million Americans voted for it, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of my opponents has come out and said, well, we got to look at case by case basis, because I'll just tell you, Lars, again, why I'm running is because we need an outsider that's going to be strong enough that actually has the ears of Oregonians already. Not just an outsider, but an outsider that actually has the ears of Oregonians, because some of my opponents in this race are already saying, hey, you know what? We just want to get the criminals out of here. Yes, we want to get the criminals out of here, but yes, we should look at other and on case by case basis, but the American people and the Oregonian people should be coming first. And that's what my campaign's about, is putting Oregonians first. We've become second class citizens in our own state. We have been devalued as Oregonians, and enough is enough. We have to start putting our own first, and then we can start taking care of everybody else.
By the way, all this no human being is illegal. No, but their behavior can be illegal. Do you know what I was thinking about this morning, and I was thinking about how I've had friends over the years and acquaintances over the years who said, yeah, we're going to rent a house in a really expensive neighborhood, Lake Oswego. And I said, why are you doing that? They said, I want my kids to go to their schools. Now, David, do you know what happens to a kid if they catch a kid signed up for school and then it turns out his parents don't live in the district? All of a sudden, borders and boundaries matter to these folks. Right? And they say, how dare you send your kids to, you know, Lake Oswego schools or West Lynn schools or whatever? You live 300 yards outside of the boundaries. And you say, this is the same crowd that says we don't want to enforce national borders. But boy, when it comes to school district boundaries, they'll enforce them all day long, even if it means kicking a kid out of a school who's only going there because he thinks, or his parents think, I'm going to get a better education in this school. Yeah, but you live 300 yards outside the boundary. You're not allowed to. Well, I'm going to do it illegally. I would love to see some conservative kid say, you know what, I'm going to sign up for whatever I think is academically the best school in the state. And when they say, do you live in the district? Say, nope. But you can't kick me out, because that would be, you'd be enforcing boundaries. And there's no such thing as an illegal student in an Oregon school. David, good luck to you. I'm really glad to see a healthy crop of people all running and seeking the Republican nomination. And I hope that all of you, I hope they take Tina Kotek apart. And at the very least, run against Tina Kotek, because guaranteed, as sure as I'm standing here, the Democrats will try to cheat in November. You've got the Lars Larson Show. And get that investment property sold. That's NickChivers.com.
This is your home for honestly provocative talk radio. The truth every day. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. Well, the Supreme Court is set to hear a major case on whether or not oil and gas companies can be held liable for climate change damage. Should local governments be able to sue, or is this a national issue, and should there be any blame at all? I think the whole idea, frankly, in my mind, sounds very, very suspect. Bonner Cohn is a senior policy analyst at the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Bonner, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Lars. Glad to be here.
The reason I say it's suspect to begin with is the oil and gas companies make a product. They make it under very, very onerous federal and state rules. They then sell that product to those of us. What we do with the product and what comes out of that product is, again, up to the way we use it. And just the idea of saying, well, somehow the climate has been damaged and you can't really show the damage, but we're going to have lots and lots of numbers and suggest, well, there's some global warming. We've done this or that. I don't understand it, because, Bonner, I'm not a lawyer, But lawyers usually, if you want to bring a lawsuit against somebody, you say, hey, Bonner drove his car through the fence in my yard, and Bonner needs to buy me a new fence. I can point to the damage and say that's the damage that was done. You could even have less well-defined things, like if you work at a job and somebody starts a whisper campaign, says, Lars has done this or Lars has done that, and it damages me, at least I could point to something and say, that's the damage, this is what I'm entitled to. How in the world do you make the case that manufacturing oil and gas under federal licenses and state licenses has somehow done some amorphous damage, and that the oil and gas companies then have to pony up hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in damage to governments that claim that they were damaged? How does that work?
That's right. Here you can not only not identify the damage, but if you accept the whole narrative undergirding their approach to this, you know that we're talking about global emissions put up by the oil and gas industry, by economic activity all over the world. What you here have is a case that was originally brought in Boulder, Colorado, and they are suing the oil and gas companies under state tort laws. State tort laws are being applied to something that is global. This is going well beyond the whole concept of extraterritorial. It's taking it to a new level. And what is really going on here is, first of all, sheer desperation on the part of green activists, seeing that the tide is going out on the vaunted transition to green energy. They have to do something. They can forget the administration. They can forget Congress. That's one of the things they're doing. So they're going to lawsuits. The other thing, of course, this is a gigantic shakedown. Local governments might get themselves in some trouble in an election year if they raise, say, property taxes. Well, why not shake down an oil company for some ill-defined damage that you claim that your jurisdiction, it could be a state, it could be a county, it could be a municipality, a village, whatever, has suffered as a result of this. So you see here the oil companies and gas companies as a cash cow, something that entities that can be exploited to your own purposes, and it does two things. It keeps the whole climate change issue alive because yep. It's now on life support, and secondly, unless the Supreme Court intervenes here, which I think it will, but unless the Supreme Court intervenes here, you've opened up a brand new spigot of money to keep yourself in power and not ruffle feathers by raising property taxes or doing other things that will scare the horses.
Well, and in fact, it ends up being a kind of tax because, Bonner, if Colorado says we're going to sue the oil companies, they owe us X number of billions of dollars, and let's say the oil companies lose and the courts decide they're right. I don't think they will. But then the oil companies pay the damages to Colorado. Colorado just sends the money to other parts of government. They don't return it to the people of Colorado who are theoretically damaged. And then the oil companies pass the costs along in the cost of their products and tax everybody who buys their products, whether they're in Colorado or somewhere else. So it's just a hidden form of tax, isn't it?
That's right. And think of the copycat effect this would have. Colorado would have its shakedown going on. Illinois, California, Washington, Oregon, New York, New Jersey, Vermont, the usual suspects would join in. What you would wind up with is a patchwork of ways of dealing with emissions across the country. Well, this interferes with interstate commerce in a manner in which we have actually never seen before. But it's an attempt on their part to keep something alive that is otherwise dying, and something that would have an absolutely devastating effect on our economy, one which cannot run without energy. particularly in this day and age with all the demands being put on electricity from artificial intelligence and supercomputers and things like that. So you have this going on, and you have an attempt here being undertaken to completely disrupt all of this for, frankly, the most selfish reasons imaginable. And these people look at their very predictable consequences of what they're doing. They shake their head and say, no, we don't care. We're saving the planet.
I almost wish, Bonner, that companies like Suncor Energy or ExxonMobil could say, oh, Colorado doesn't want our product. Our product is damaging Colorado. Okay, we'll turn off the spigot. We'll send our product to some other state. But if you shortchange the supply to Colorado from two major companies, I would think that gas prices would respond. And when people said, why are gas prices going up and they're lower next door? Well, next door didn't sue us, and you folks did. That's Bonner Cohen with the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Bonner, it's always a pleasure.
The Lars Larson Show. Show today? Find Lars's thoughts and get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, here's Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's not a pleasure to tell you that it appears that racial discrimination is coming back to the state of California. Now, I don't live in California. I did when I was a little kid. But the California Assembly has just approved ACA 7, which aims to undo decades of race-neutral policies in K-12 schools. And I want to get the details from Wenyuan Wu, who joins me now, Executive Director of Californians for Equal Rights Foundation. Ms. Wu, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mr. Larson,
Ms. Wu,
for having me.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
That's all right.
I think I just misgendered you, which means the Democrats will want to string me up one of these days. Tell me what the California Assembly is doing with ACA 7.
So the Assembly just approved this measure, and now it's going to the State Senate for committee process and possibly a full vote. And then if the state Senate approves ACA 7, then it will be on the November 2026 ballot for the California voters to decide whether or not they want to repeal Proposition 209 in terms of education. So this was actually the third time the California state legislature has been trying in the last 6 years to try to bring back race-based affirmative action. The first time happened in 2020 with a measure called Assembly Constitutional Matter Amendment 5, so ACA 5, and that one was successfully put on the state ballot in November 2020. Luckily, it was voted down by over 9.6 million Californian voters, so voters from different political leanings and different backgrounds. Or said, no, we don't want to revive government's preferences based on race, sex, color, or national origin, right? And that was the first time. And 2 years ago, the state assembly tried to pass a bill under the same name, ACA 7, that had tried to add an exemption mechanism to Proposition 209. Proposition 209 is California's state constitutional guarantee of equal rights, which was voted about 30 years ago by 55% of voters. And now the politicians in Sacramento are at it again, trying. So long story short, the new ACA 7 tries to only repeal the education-related provisions or part aspects of Proposition 209. And there is an exception to that. So they exclude public college enrollment and college admissions, which has been governed under the Supreme Court ruling in Harvard versus students for fair admissions versus Harvard. So they want to bring back racial preferences in all other areas of public education, from financial aid to access to gifted and talented education, to teacher training, to other professional development, you name it. So we're doing this again to try to stop this.
Wen Yuan Wu is the executive director of Californians for Equal Rights Foundation. Ms. Wu, what's driving their desire to bring back racial preferences? Can they point to something and say, gee, this is a terrible situation. We have to go back to racial preferences. It will benefit Californians. What's the argument they're making in favor of this?
They are making an argument based on rhetoric and ideology, not on any empirical evidence or just public opinions, because we have shown them time and again, the public, regardless of where we stand politically, we don't want racial preferences, but the politicians are so out of touch from the realities or from their electorate, from their constituency, that they think that they can bring this back. Now, this ACA 7 measure is specifically introduced last year as a reparations bill, which means that the California Legislative Black Caucus promotes it as one of its reparations package priorities. And what they're saying is that they need to assault the state's ban on race-based affirmative action when it comes to education, so that they can bring more equity and representation for Black Californians. And there is no evidence, or it's not grounded in.
Well, isn't it insulting to people of color to say you can't do it on your own with a level playing field, so we have to unlevel the playing field, otherwise Black or Hispanic Americans cannot go out and compete on their own in seeking places in schools?
Yes, sir, absolutely. This is insulting, this is dehumanizing, and it takes away agency, and it takes away initiative from the so-called, underrepresented minority groups that this bill purports to help or uplift or level the playing field for. In fact, my co-author for this piece, this commentary, Eli Steele, he is part Black and part Jewish, and he has been opposing this kind of government-endorsed discrimination for at least the last two decades. So it's not popular among the public. There's no reasoning. There's no data that supports it. It's just ideology and partisan politics.
Well, should we be confident, Ms. Wu, that the voters will reject it then, or are we running a real risk that they'll be snowed by a PR campaign between now and the vote?
We should be alarmed. So I say that because back in 2020, I was the executive director of the campaign that tried to beat a similar measure called Proposition 16, which tried to repeal the state's ban affirmative action entirely. And we won by 57.2%. That was a wide margin, but we did a very, very difficult campaign in that we were outspent at a ratio of 1 to 14. The other side had a war chest of $31 million. We raised a little bit over $1.5 million. And we had no endorsement or support from media platforms, with the exception of Orange County Reporter and the Wall Street Journal.
Well, I'm glad to see you got that support. That is Wen Yuan Wu, the executive director of Californians for Equal Rights Foundation. And they're concerned, and I'm concerned, that Constitutional Amendment Number 7 would bring back race-based preferences to California.
Larson wants to hear from you, even if you disagree. Naysayers get to cut the line at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, here's Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I think school choice should be a choice of every single child in America. And now, with the addition of 75 programs in 34 different states, more than half of America's K-12 students are now eligible to take part in an education choice program if they want to. The problem is, here in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon and Washington, not so very much. Catherine Hickok joins me now, who's Executive VP at the Cascade Policy Institute and Director of Cascade's Children's Scholarship Fund Oregon program. Catherine, welcome back.
Hi, Lars. Great to be with you.
Is it going to become clear, you think, to parents that their kids, if they live in a state like Oregon or Washington, are simply being cheated out of an opportunity that half the kids in K-12 school around America can get to, but the kids in the Northwest are locked out of?
The more states that enact school choice programs, the more it's going to become apparent to other states that they need to do something to increase educational options for the kids in their own states, because it's becoming a mainstream option in a lot of the country, as you just said.
Well, in fact, 2 weeks ago today, on the 4th of February, something happened in Texas that actually was notable. What happened in Texas on that day?
Well, last year, the Texas legislature enacted what was, at that time, the largest school choice program at its inception in the country, funding an education freedom program that would help 90,000 students initially, with a total investment of $1 billion. And just 2 weeks ago, applications opened for that program, and 42,000 parents applied, breaking Tennessee's record of 33,000 first-day applications for its program last year. So that means a lot of kids in Texas are going to get a different option this year.
So there's a great hunger out there among parents to get their kids into some kind of school choice.
Yes, the support has been overwhelming, and these programs are growing. It's pretty common that when these application windows open, parents have very quickly run to apply, and they end up expanding those programs in subsequent years.
And by the way, Catherine, I understand everybody will stand in line when they're offered something free. But in this case, this isn't free. This is paid for by the taxpayers. Most of the parents, I would imagine, those students are taxpayers. But usually putting your kid into some kind of school choice is a lot more work for the parents, maybe even for the kids as well, than simply sending them off to whatever neighborhood school is offered up by the government-run K-12 system, isn't it?
That's right, and it's a great point that you bring up, Lars, because that's not that often discussed. Schools that accept children who are using these school choice programs do still have their own standards, and so families are choosing to help their kids meet the academic and behavioral and attendance standards of those schools, mostly private schools, but a lot of these programs allow kids to go to different kinds of educational environments, some of which may be quasi-public, or there may be some kind of hybrid aspect to it. But yeah, as you point out, private schools do have requirements for their families and the kids, and these are things that people are voluntarily signing up to do because that's what they want for their children. They want those higher standards, and they want what it means for their kids' education.
I'm talking to Catherine Hickok, who's Vice President at Cascade Policy Institute and Director of the Children's Scholarship Fund Oregon. The reason I want to make that point is it fair to say that in most of these school choice options scenarios, it's not coming free of charge. It's not as though the public system says, here's the school choice money, it'll cover the entire cost of private school tuition. In most cases, the parents are going to have to come up with something. So they're actually signing up for something that takes more time and more effort and oftentimes more money from them, does it not?
That's right. Every school choice program in every state is different. They're funded at different levels. Some may be a couple $1,000s, some may be $10,000 or more. But it is really much more common that it is only a partial assistance. So parents are spending a significant amount of tuition themselves in a lot of cases, or they may be receiving entirely charitable funding in scholarships also, and combining those possibilities. But yes, most of these programs do not cover the full cost of the children's education, and parents are investing themselves.
I guess, Catherine, it kind of reminds me, do you remember, and you probably have a better memory of this than I do, but under George W. Bush in the early 2000s, Washington, D.C. offered up a program, and I think they were paying maybe half of the tuition, and in a notoriously low income or lower income outside of the government classes, a lot of low income people in Washington, D.C. and the 5 million people who live there, and a lot of people in families of color who said immediately, we will take that. We will. But it required them to put up almost as much money, sometimes $2,000 or $3,000 a year, to get their kid into a private situation instead of just sending them off to whatever school. But I remember that program. And I remember that Barack Hussein Obama did away with the program. So imagine this. You live in Washington, D.C. I understand if you work in the government, you make very good money. If you're a politician, you'll become a millionaire through various illicit means. But if you're one of the average folks in Washington, D.C., you're not necessarily rich. And that one turned out to be hugely popular, even though it required a very substantial financial contribution by the parents.
That's right. Yeah, and it's that exact same thing goes on all over the country all the time, and people are often surprised at the kinds of sacrifices that low-income parents will make in order to get their children into a school where they're going to learn and be successful and come out the end a high school graduate.
And I guess what I think of is, Catherine, every time somebody has skin in the game, in this case dollars in the game, parents who are shelling out even a couple $100 a month to be able to put their kid in a school, they don't often do that and then say, I don't care if the kid shows up. I don't care if they do their homework. Parents who've got a dog in the fight, a child in the school system, but their money is on the line as well, and they've done all this extra time and effort and money, they would tend to say to their kids, you're going to make use of this education because mom and dad are paying out of our pockets for part of it. That's Catherine Hickok. Catherine is the Executive Vice President of Cascade Policy. By the way, we didn't get into it. It's the teachers' unions that fight school choice every single day.
The Lars Larson Show.
Experienced attorneys at Oregon Gun Law.